Smith. Dr. John Smith.
I say, what a wonderful butler. He's so violent.
It's a bingle bongle, dingle dangle, yickety doo, yickety da, ping pong, lippy tappy too ta.
Scrambled his memory. Give him a big old dream about being Dan the Soldier Man. I shall miss him. Yes, I shall miss him. As from this moment, there's no such thing as free will in the entire universe. There's only my will, because I possess the key to time.
Doctor.
You will obey me.
He must be found and destroyed.
I think I've ever misjudged anybody quite as badly as I did Lytton.
You may be a doctor, but I'm the doctor. The definite article, you might say.
And I know things. Secrets that must never be told. Knowledge that must never be spoken.
Unimaginable power! Unlimited rice pudding!
Excellent. Absolutely. Exquisite.
And with that, we begin. Welcome, time travelers, to the Who's On podcast. Hosted by me, Barry, joined by Rob and Dan.
Hi.
Hello.
Three lifetime Doctor Who fans from the United States. We are the American Doctor Who podcast.
The American Doctor
Apparently,
Who
we're pod. Number one on Google. So, Mummy on the Orient Express this week. Season 8, Episode 8, written by Jamie Matheson. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I believe so.
Or Matheson?
I think it's Matheson. I think it's just one of those weird English names.
Any info on the author here, Dan?
He did a rather obscure independent British film called Frequently Asked Questions About Time Travel, or FAQ, or whoever you say that, FAQ. Mm-hmm. About time travel. That starred Chris O'Dowd, who was one of the main stars in The IT Crowd, which is a show that I enjoy very much, or enjoyed because it finished. It dealt with a lot of themes. I kind of felt like this guy should be writing for Doctor Who when I was watching the movie, because it dealt with a lot of like clever kind of time travel ideas. But I saw that movie about 4 years ago, I think. Oh, cool. And he hasn't done that much since. He's fairly young. But that's where I knew him from.
For TV, I guess. I guess as an author, they put out books, I would think, right? To be considered.
I guess. I mean.
Still on the planet, you know, still in contact with the Moth.
Hmm.
But anyway, what did you feel about this episode, Rob?
It was fun. It wasn't a blow me away episode. I think there were a couple things I was a little bit kind of like getting too hung up on some of the details, but enjoying taking the episode as just a whole. Like it was a fun, a little bit more of like a classic Doctor Who story, just in the sense of, you know, it's not taking place in Cardiff. But no, it was good though. I enjoyed it.
What were your initial feelings, Dan?
I enjoyed it a lot. I liked it quite a bit. I thought that the monster was very well realized. Hmm. I liked the concept of it. And I liked the fact that it called back to, was it the Christmas, Matt Smith's first Christmas episode, where he said he got the phone call?
Yeah, I did see that.
To the Orient Express.
Yeah, actually I have it here somewhere in my stack. Oh, yeah, the phone call in the Big Bang when Matt Smith replies, an Egyptian goddess loose on the Orient Express in space?
Hmm. That's funny. Yeah, I had forgotten about that. I didn't pick up on that.
And, he referenced that. That was like the mysterious, what's his name?
Gus.
Call me?
Gus.
Gus. And actually, Gus, the voice of Gus is John Sessions, who is a a fairly well-known British comedian. I know him from... Where do I know him from? I know him from something. Let me see.
Okay.
I thought I knew him from something, but it's not the person I thought he was.
I think he was in Stephen Fry used to have that. What was Stephen Fry's show that he had people on and they would discuss silly things? And David Tennant had been on it a couple times. There was a bunch of comedians on there, and I'm mental block.
Yeah, you know.
John Sessions, I believe, was involved. I thought he was involved with the. Looking at it as himself. He was, Whose Line Is It? Yes, he was in 20 episodes of Whose Line Is It Anyway, the British version.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I'm sure he was in Stephen Fry.
I think that's where
too.
I know him from.
All right.
And he did do some stuff with Stephen Fry.
Yeah, because I think I saw his face and I recognized him from there. This is supposedly Clara's last hurrah. Because of the week before, we saw Clara basically say, you know, you go far away.
Yeah, go away.
Don't come back kind of thing. And apparently the doctor came back and this was supposed to be their nice relaxing send-off.
Yeah.
And so during the course of the episode, it's revealed that the doctor had received phone calls on the TARDIS about this. And that's where the big bang comes in. The Matt Smith episode. And so Clara is really just ticked off at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, at the end of the episode, she still, she lies. She's becoming a master of deceit.
Yep.
And she lies. Oh, Danny's, he's fine with it when it's not.
Yeah, he's fine with it. She convinces the girl who's with her. I can't think of her name. But
right.
Lies when the doctor tells her to, and she really doesn't put up that much of a fight against it. But...
And the reason Clara is just more and more. I'm watching this season. It's the best season for Clara, definitely. Because as my wife says, when the companion separates themselves from the doctor, that's when they have their growth. That's when you like a companion, Barry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's when you see the character development. And the development is all of the doctor's bad habits.
But at least she's developing her own. You know, you're not watching the episode to watch the doctor and his shadow named Clara.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You're getting to see her as her own person.
To look pretty and ask stupid questions.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's funny, actually watching the episode, considering the previous episode and her behavior in this episode and the whole idea of it, you know, being her last episode, I just said episode like 7 times in a row. That was ridiculous to me. Anyway, I was actually thinking back to how at the beginning of the season, I had heard a couple times that that Jenna Coleman had actually said she was done being Clara. And I was starting to wonder, if some of these episodes were written expecting her to leave and now she's maybe decided she wasn't going to, or if maybe it was just fans misinterpreting what was going on.
A British tabloid reported that she was leaving, but it's never been confirmed by any,
like anybody close to her or whatever
source, I suppose.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In fact, they asked her and she was like, if I were to answer that question, I could potentially give away spoilers about the end of the season. So I'm not going to say one way or another I am or if I'm not.
Okay.
Do you remember what, publication posted that?
I don't know if it was the Mirror or the Guardian. I guess it was one of the bigger British tabloids. Right. It might have been the Mirror.
Okay. Yeah, because that was my thinking too. So we learn about in this episode about this the foretold, this mummy who's as the author I think described. We have episodes about. Vampires and werewolves, and there's like the mummy is like the second class citizen of scary things.
Yeah.
And so I thought the horror of this thing was truly visualized. It was really well done.
Even from the get-go, I think just right away with the old woman, like The look on her face was awesome.
The old woman is, she's one of my favorites. That's Janet Henfrey, and she was in The Curse of Fenric. She was the old woman who played the religious nut who didn't want the two girls to go down to the water. Come into the water, they kept saying, and they were turning into the Curse of Fenric's thing. She was the nasty lady in that one too, and she was old then. What's that, Dan?
I didn't realize.
Yeah, I liked the clock on the screen, so you had a real time kind of setting. It added to the tension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you didn't get a chance to get lost in like the episode, like what was going on. Like you actually had to keep track of like it's almost time. Yeah.
Yeah, and Skinner, Frank Skinner, who played Perkins, you know, kept the stopwatch and.
Mm-hmm.
And he was told when to start the clock, and the lights kind of shimmered when it was time. It was very neat. It definitely, this episode had me on the end of my seat, which is what a good horror story is supposed to be.
Exactly. It's especially Doctor Who. That's really what it should do to us, I think. I think they've taken a little bit soft on people the last couple seasons. Not that I don't appreciate the last couple seasons, but I think some of the edge of the seat kind of climb behind your couch because it's scaring you stuff. We haven't really had the last couple seasons.
And interesting too, because we're going to be discussing Flatline in a little bit. Jamie Matheson, both of his monsters never spoke.
Hmm.
Didn't realize.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that either.
Although technically in the second episode, they were being translated, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, I guess a number.
We were saying numbers.
Right. But you never actually heard, you know, it was just, I thought it was an interesting observation. Because usually when you're scared of the evil guy has the, you know, the Mark Gatiss, Doctor.
Yeah, it's true.
Kind of thing.
They have that, yeah, they have that scary voice, quote unquote, to, instill the fear.
Who was the villain from the Rise of the Cybermen? The guy in the wheelchair.
Right.
From beyond the grave.
It's
very, very over the top.
Mm-hmm.
So the line goes, he's the professor of alien mythology, this guy that the doctor gets as an expert.
Quill, right? I think it was his name.
And he says, the number of evil twice over, they that bear the foretold stare have 66 to live. So they have 66 seconds is how the old... I love when people come up with new like little poems to describe things that's supposed to be like some old prophecy or something. It's really cool.
What's funny to me about it is like... I'm going to nitpick a little bit of the fine details about science fact, not science fiction. So I'm guessing that the prophecy of the foretold or whatever this little thing, the curse of the foretold, it originates from Earth or Egypt because, you know, the way we broke time down into hours, minutes, and seconds is because of the specific size of the Earth's orbit around the sun. So
okay.
And if this is a train in space, then technically, I guess, it could just as likely be originating from other galaxies,
their
right?
Earth seconds. It's not Dalek rels or any other measuring tool.
It's just interesting that, you know, when you think about the fact that it's a train in space, it's probably covering more space than just Earth, and yet...
And, of course, I had a geekasm when the doctor offered the professor a jelly baby from a cigarillo case.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Great.
And he doesn't say, do you want a jelly baby?
He doesn't say anything. He just flips it out.
You can't beat Tom Baker saying, "Can I? Do you want a
jelly baby?
Yeah, do you want a jelly baby? Matt Smith, even when they actually had him say that, used Tom Baker's voice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, too, because the look on the doctor's face, not the doctor, but
the
doctor, the professor. Yes, there we go.
Yeah. Professor Morehouse.
That's it, Morehouse. Yeah, as he was eating the jelly baby, I thought it was funny because he was kind of like confused, but at the same time enjoyed it.
Again, we see a writing, too, that the TARDIS hasn't translated.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there was the demon pit. It's like this writing is so old that even the TARDIS doesn't know what it... But occasionally we do see, and they never made comment about it in this one.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that. I guess because they haven't really made a point of it in a while. almost all the stories have been taking place on Earth the last few seasons, so we haven't had much of a point in bringing up the TARDIS's translating abilities.
Yeah.
We haven't had any alien life that we've had to translate. We haven't had, you know, writing.
So basically what happens in this episode is the mummy goes after those who, well, we find out the doctor finds out that the mummy is going after the most sick, whether psychologically or
physically.
Yeah. So this, whether it be shell shock or what, liver disease or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
So we find that the captain's worst nightmare is a mystery shopper, apparently, because that's what the psychic paper told him. The doctor was quite surprised and unexpectedly.
That was, yeah, the interchange with that was classic. Oh, a mystery shopper. Really? A mystery shopper? That's what you're most scared of.
And then when, of course, the professor doesn't tell the doctor and Perkins what they actually want to hear, Perkins kind of sidles up to the doctor. Can we get a new expert?
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very cute, his character. And a lot of people were thinking that Perkins might be Gus.
Oh, well, if you look at the interchange, I mean, that's such a typical, like, kind of horror movie.
Yeah,
you think
where
about
the good,
like,
guy becomes the evil guy at the end.
Yeah, well, you think about, like, Scream. I mean, come on, you know, like that kind of thing. Like, you know,
I don't think about Scream.
Oh, okay. Well, the boyfriend ends up being
Jennifer
the murderer.
Jennifer Love Hewitt, though, I'll have to make exception for.
Yeah, I don't. Wait.
Perkins was really kind of doing the same thing that the doctor does, and a lot of times the doctor, again, the doctor was actually accused of being the instigator behind it until like 30 seconds later someone else died.
Yeah.
And the doctor also said too that the delivery of all this information by Perkins was a little too convenient.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Perkins, of course, replied that,
well, maybe I've already been working on this. Yeah.
So it's interesting. So what basically has to happen in this episode is that apparently there's all these professors and scientists and, I guess, Egyptologists, who knows, that are on this specific train, and Gus has them all here for the purpose of figuring out what the mummy is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you'll play audio clip number one, the nearly dead have to describe what they see so that the future person can beat this thing.
Actually, seeing it in the flesh isn't nearly as rewarding as I thought it might be.
Oh dear, Hargeese, but can you see details?
Yes, of course, of course. Well, it just looks like a man in bandages.
What kind of bandages? Old, new?
Old, ragged? Ragged, falling off from places. I don't know what you want me to tell you.
Listen to me. You can see this thing. We can't. Tell us what you can see. Even the smallest detail might help us save the next one.
The next one? You mean you can't save me?
Well, that is implied, isn't it? Yes, this is probably the end for you. But make it count! Details, please!
Flesh. Some of it
30
is...
30 seconds.
Leathery, ancient looking. Peat bog preserved.
Keep talking. Don't waste this chance.
I want to bargain for my life.
Whoa, what are you doing?
It says if you find the right word, if you make the right offer, then it lets you go.
This is not a myth. This is real. Forget your superstition. Tell us what you can see.
This is my life. My death. I'm going to fight for it how I want. I give you
10 seconds.
So, I confess all my sins. I give you all my worldly goods. Only, please. No!
Zero.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was an awesome scene. I loved how, under the pressure, the guy who had spent apparently the majority of his life researching all this kind of paranormal weird stuff, when he was finally face to face with it, he still broke down and did like the kind of more expected human behavior of groveling, you know, like at the hands of the imminent death.
And actually, like, the later on, the captain of the train, the ex-soldier, really did approach it much more. What's the word? Peacefully, I suppose. I mean, he did fire his gun, but he said, "What's a soldier with a loaded weapon?" You know,
right? Yeah, if he doesn't, yeah.
But he thanked the doctor at the end for allowing him this chance, you know, to redeem himself.
Yeah, I was going to say, kind of to actually, like, fall in the line of battle, you know, like, in the line of duty instead of just being a coward.
And he said
that,
you know, it's like, this is not a bad way for a soldier to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he definitely was more stoic, maybe. Is that the right word? Kind of in his death?
Interesting, too, though, he was someone who suffered from nightmares. He couldn't go to sleep without pills, mm-hmm. too. So perhaps those nightmares, they say dreams prepare you for the things that you're about to do in life. Hmm. Maybe he was a little more prepared in that way because of the condition, his PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's true.
But yeah, that was, and of course, being the person that I am, I immediately put myself in the shoes of the one who is about to get killed. And what could you do? How would I have, gone about trying to bargain?
Yeah.
And I think, as you see, and during the episode, they were all taking it from the wrong perspective. The idea wasn't to bargain for mm-hmm. your life. The idea was to surrender
yourself.
Understand
what he was there for. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's, so the doctor took a different tact.
Yeah. Well, he was being the, out of all the scientists in the room, I think he's the only one that approached it with more of a psychological aspect, I guess. I don't know if psychological is even the right word. Maybe just dealing with the humanity of the situation instead of trying to find, like, the
mythology. Yeah, he tried to understand who the mummy was in
exactly.
his life.
Mm-hmm. He didn't view it as so much of a monster as something that he wanted to help. He wanted to understand why it was happening instead of just trying to find the resolution for it.
And he saw the monster as a slave to something that was using mm-hmm. it, too. Yeah. Just like we saw in the previous episode, Time Heist, where the monster there was a
right.
slave.
Yeah.
And I think that the doctor sees things a little deeper in that way. He said that there was ancient tech going on.
Mm-hmm.
What is 66 seconds? What needs 66 seconds? Come on, you're all pudding heads. Mm-hmm. These are supposed to be people who are brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seemed that he and Perkins were the only two that really were working well together.
Yeah, maybe because they weren't working they weren't working from their degrees. You know, they were working from just experience.
And instinct.
Yeah, exactly.
And at one point, Perkins was mourning, I believe it was the captain.
Yeah.
And the doctor just replied, people with guns to their head can't mourn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't have the time for that.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's, of course, used to that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So the tech, the ancient tech, it drains the energy from living cells, moving energy out of phase. And that's what they kind of figured. So the doctor took all the, I don't know what that machine was. Did they ever say what the machine was that he used on the woman?
He said more or less.
A scanner or something?
Yeah, like it was like extracting her neural activity, I guess, and implanting it into himself.
Maisie was her name.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Based on whatever thoughts that she was going through, whatever she was experiencing in her head, in her mind at the time, that he transferred that.
Yeah, so the doctor gives himself her trauma, her grief, her resentment. Apparently she had issues with her grandmother that mm-hmm. was the first to die on the train. And, of course, the Are You My Mummy joke was there, but it was kind of like hollow and wasn't really pulled off well because of the situation of the... they would have been better to leave that unsaid.
Yeah, yeah. It almost made it cheap.
Yeah, whereas in the Santarin episode that David Tennant used it with all the gas going on, that was actually very funny when he said it to mm-hmm. the commander or the brigadier, whoever he was. Brigadier, I believe it was at the time. So the TARDIS is blocked by a force field. So this, whoever Gus is like incredibly powerful.
Well, see, that's the thing is like when I was watching it, there were like the one or two things I was kind of, it was neat to what, well, I'll say one thing that was really neat to me was the whole, how do I describe it? Like just the way the technology, like the interface technology was, it was very much like, wow, I can't think of the name of the game series right now. But BioShock, like the way that they had like all like the lights turning from red to green, like the access doors, like you may enter now. Like it's very the way that like the vending machines in BioShock are.
It reminded me a little bit also of BioShock and like the Fallout games.
That's
with, like,
what
the thumbs up and the thumbs down.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say, Fallout, yeah. I mean BioShock as well, but Fallout was the first one I was thinking of. So it was neat because it's in line with that whole 20s kind of theme anyway. That's kind of where Fallout was set around and BioShock too. And but I thought it was kind of weird though that not just the force field, but the when they had the sarcophagus and they were talking about how the doctor was saying how, like, whoever it is, they want us to trap it. And I thought it was weird that they just kind of, like, dropped the whole thing with the sarcophagus after Clara and Maisie were going through the files talking about the previous train rides or whatever it was that they said.
Yeah.
Which
Gus had done this experiment before with people.
Which was another thing that was funny to me. One thing I was wondering about was those other, the files they found, was it relating to the same thing? Was it relating to the foretold? Or was it some other mythological beast that he was doing it with, that they were trying to understand it?
Implicitly, it could be anything.
Yeah, that's kind of why
I was... It seemed like they were talking about the mummy, the foretold.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but that would be open for debate.
Yeah, because I mean, they kind of left it open. They didn't. They just basically just said that. Yeah, at the end of the thing, the ride, there were no survivors. Which we find out at the end of the episode that it's planned that there would be no survivors at the end of the train ride anyway.
Yeah.
Even after they solved it, and it was just interesting to me to think. So then, that the people that are doing this work, are they doing it so that somebody can build up a collection of monsters? Like, I don't know.
It was interesting to me that the voice himself and the way everything kind of worked out reminded me of the Doctor's Wife episode.
Mm-hmm.
With the thing that Rory and Amy were trying to get away from within the TARDIS, and it had that kind of I've trapped Time Lords. The boxes are going to make him angry, and that kind of.
Right.
It seemed like that same kind of powerful force that would be unstoppable. And there has been that all through this whole season, where there's something beyond, and that's falls in line with the whole Missy arc, where it's almost Black Guardian-ish, something over everything else that he can do anything. Impose his will on each and every story in a different way.
That's kind of where I was thinking about that, where this was going to end up going. I was kind of surprised when they left the Gus thing at just Gus, that it was as if it was like the machine, but obviously
they made it like it was the computer. But the computer wouldn't destroy himself, so he wouldn't kill.
So it had to be programmed by somebody.
He wouldn't blow up the Orient Express with him being on board.
Unless, of course, it's just streaming all the information and the main computer is actually in the cloud. But that's
there you go. So basically, we have at the finish Clara and the doctor on the beach, and the doctor making the joke that, you know, everyone else died. It's just us. And he always kind of leaves Clara guessing, because she has he knows that she looks at him a certain way as being this really nasty, evil guy. In a way, not good, just someone whose morality is relative to the situation.
Yeah.
Sort of amoral.
He's got a higher perspective than she can possibly get, I think, is what it comes down to. She's still battling with the fact that this guy's, somewhere between 900 and 1,200 years old.
No, he's 2,000. I believe he says that.
Oh, that's 2000. Right. That's
yeah,
right.
He's 2,000.
So.
And... So he did save everyone on there that were still alive, and we know that he can survive without air because of his respiratory bypass system. So apparently he got the teleporters working, and that was what the mummy was using to jump from behind the person to in front of the person, whether they ran away or not.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently the writing was... some kind of flag or something that signified that he was a soldier. So we have the soldier theme again, and it won't let him die. It won't let the war end. And he saluted the doctor at the end, the end, when the doctor said, "I surrender," and the mummy kind of just saluted him.
Which is interesting when you think, actually, I hadn't thought about this. Sorry, I totally jumped in front of you with that.
No,
but that actually, it's interesting because a soldier wouldn't, I mean, as far as I know, a soldier wouldn't salute to just anybody that was surrendering.
No, Danny Pink saluted to the officer, doctor.
That's, yeah, exactly. Danny said that the doctor was an officer. That soldier recognized the doctor as an officer because he saluted, even as an enemy, he saluted to him, which, you know, he would have to be higher ranked than him even as an enemy. Just kind of interesting because that's kind of a newer thing that they play off of.
This season has been very well written.
I'll say Steve is doing a great job at making me eat my words over the last couple seasons.
Are you a believer? That's the theme song for this.
Oh yeah, I guess.
Are you a believer?
Oh, that's another completely forgot to make the point about the cover of Queen at the beginning of the episode. It's awesome. Job of covering Don't Stop Me Now.
I thought Foxes was really good. Never heard of her before. She's probably not that well known outside of the UK.
Yeah.
But I thought she looked a little bit like Jennifer Charles from the Elysian Fields.
Mm-hmm. She had a very, very older style bangs that she had that you don't see around anymore.
Yeah.
As far as I know, I'm not really in tune with a lot of contemporary kind of stuff like that, but yeah, why is her name Foxes? Foxes is plural. I don't know. Maybe I'm
because she can.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So one of another theme for this whole season is sometimes that the only choices we have are bad choices, but you still have to make a choice. Mm. You still have to choose is what the doctor has been trying to ingrain into Clara when Matt Smith was there.
Yeah.
And so it's an overarching theme of this season where the bad choices are put in front of us and we have to choose. And so often that's the way it is in life. And then hopefully when you start making the right bad choices, good choices will be in front of you, I would think.
Yeah.
Or you don't have that. I mean, I hope that...
I guess that's the point. But yeah, I mean, you know, I was always brought up saying two wrongs never makes a right. But hey, you know, I guess we'll see how the season plays out.
Yeah.
But then again, there was a comment at the end of the next episode, which we'll talk about later, that...
So Perkins the engineer could have stayed on, and that's what he really wanted to do. He's a lifetime Doctor Who fan.
I know, yeah.
And he wanted...
I'm the one who had to turn him down.
Yeah, and he wanted a shot of a take of them accepting.
Yeah.
That's funny. That's funny.
It's like a job like this can change a man.
That whole scene I just thought was incredible. Just the fact that, like, Perkins, you know, we knew that he was smart because, like you said, he was already researching it. And the fact that, like, he just kind of, like, looked around the TARDIS, not even really, like, forlornly, just kind of like, this is too much. Like, you know.
It was cool because the Doctor always kind of treated him on a level playing field, which is something that the Doctor doesn't do with a whole lot of people.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of respected him.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he wasn't a pudding brain as his.
Right, right.
Yeah.
He keeps calling everyone,
and I think it's funny because even like from their first encounter on the train car, where like it's dark and you know Perkins you know approaches the doctor first about like what's a man doing locked in a train car with a dead body, you know, and the doctor turns it right back around and basically asks him the same question, and they just look at each other with like understanding.
The doctor says smarmily that he's a nosy Parker,
right? Yeah,
and with a little grin on his face too, because it's like I don't know, peas in a pod, these two.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. It would be cool to see somebody that good. I don't know if that's the right word. But that smart, that quick, to be in the TARDIS with the Doctor. But at the same time, I think he might have ended up being too much like the Doctor for it to work.
I don't know. An older man, an alpha male.
Mm-hmm. But then again, we did also have Romana, who was basically a female version of the Doctor anyway, so...
She got more and more like the Doctor as it progressed from Mary Tam to Lala Ward.
Mm-hmm.
And she later became president of Gallifrey.
Yep.
So Danny calls and tells they both love each other, and he reciprocates, and Clara says he's fine with it. Mm-hmm. So Clara lies, and so she says, let's keep going. And she almost has this look... this is her high, and they discuss like almost like an adrenaline, like, I've never tried to give it up. Have you ever tried to give it up? And she just can't stop.
Mm-hmm.
Cause there was a time when the doctor in this episode, the doctor was about to knock on her door to investigate, and he leaves her alone because this is not what Clara wanted. Clara wanted to be left out of these things. This was supposed to be a nice, relaxing little voyage, a send off, a farewell.
Yeah, it was almost not, I don't think quite at the same level, but you could almost see Capaldi's face almost mirroring a little bit of Hartnell's with saying goodbye to Ian and Barbara. Like, not quite as intense, I don't think, but the whole like, well, it's, you know, she said she's done. You know,
yeah, he just
he's
going to
kind of back off a little bit.
He's fiddling with knobs and switches on the thing, just kind of like looking up a little bit. Like, what is she doing? What is she going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And hoping.
He's being like a kid. You
yes.
know, walk around kicking the rock, looking up, waiting. Like,
exactly.
Is mom going to take me for ice cream? Or, you know.
One thing I thought that was important about this episode was the moment when the doctor gets Clara to lie for him,
mm-hmm.
To Maisie.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, at that moment, I thought this was the doctor at his lowest. Because I really believed that he had no intention. Because all throughout this season, we see him kind of coldly sort of tossing aside people who he felt were lost cases. So I'm like, yeah, he's completely thinking that Maisie's the same, and he's just going to sacrifice her just to get more data, because that's the kind of doctor that he is. And then to turn around and have all the time just to bring her there so he could steal that, and then so he could encounter
yeah.
the Forsaken and deal with it, I thought it was a nice switch, because I actually believed it at that moment. That and then to see that Clara did it, and that she did tell her that she was going to be all right.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment, was thinking, you know, that it wasn't true, and then getting angry at the doctor about getting her to lie for him.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, basically, you know, this is it. This is it.
Well, they also did that too, because the computer had them in this little room and wouldn't let them out. And so the doctor was trying to trick the computer as well.
Yeah, trying to convince the computer that we're going to use her for the study that she told us we had to do.
Yeah, he later explains why he did that. But it's, yeah, Clara is becoming more and more like the doctor. And it reminds me, too, of when Rory kind of like pushed the doctor up against the wall and says, "You're not going to make me like you."
Mm. Yeah.
During the hotel episode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that Rory always had sort of a nobility about him, because he would never stoop and become Doctor-esque.
Mm-hmm.